Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Malaysia expands search for missing plane, Vietnam suspends its search, and we hear from an author who assesses China's military innovations. These stories and more on this Thursday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Malaysia has again expanded the vast area where it is looking for the missing jetliner with 239 people on board, but acknowledges it is likely a search mission rather than a rescue effort. Transport Minister Hishamuddin Hussein said Wednesday that ships and aircraft from 12 countries are now searching more than 90,000 square kilometers of water, looking for a Boeing 777 aircraft that disappeared from air traffic radar screens early Saturday. He said the fifth day of the search is focused on the Strait of Malacca and the South China Sea, but now also extends far to the northwest toward India. He rejected growing criticism that the search has become mired in confusion, with Malay officials issuing contradictory reports about the effort. Hishamuddin said officials have turned over military radar information to American air safety experts to try to determine where the flight went. The plane disappeared from civilian radar without any distress calls about an hour after leaving Kuala Lumpur en route to Beijing early Saturday, when weather conditions appeared to be clear. Meanwhile, China has released satellite images of what it says could be parts of the missing plane floating in the South China Sea. A Chinese Defense Ministry statement said the images were taken on Sunday and not released until Wednesday. The images show three objects floating in the sea, but it is difficult to tell what the objects are. No one else involved in the investigation can confirm what the images show. Amid the frustration of conflicting information, Vietnam has, for now, pulled out of the search. VOA Susan Yaki spoke about the decision with reporter Lian Huang in Ho Chi Minh City.
Vietnam announced this morning on Phu Quoc Island that it was pulling out of the search, and it was within a day, so a few hours after news reports emerged that Malaysia might have tracked the missing plane off its western coast. So it seemed pretty pointless for Vietnam to continue its search if the plane was probably 1,000 miles away.
Is there any possibility it might resume its search?
Well, it is still keeping some air forces out there looking, I think just as a contingency. But I think that the likelihood of anything coming of that is very, very low.
How much effort had they put into the search? Were there a lot of vessels involved?
There were, actually. Officials initially declined to give a figure, a monetary figure, but it looks like they spent about $1 million a day helping Malaysia look for the missing plane. So they haven't totally scaled back. I mean, they haven't totally suspended all activity, but most of that cost should be going away tomorrow.
Have Vietnamese officials expressed any disappointment with how the search has been handled as far as having so many nations involved? Is it being coordinated well?
I don't think it's being coordinated well from this end or from Malaysia. We've asked the officials pretty directly how they feel about Malaysia's lack of communication and whether they're disappointed. And I think officially they can't say that they're angry with Malaysia, but Vietnam has put in a lot of effort to help its ally, and it isn't getting much response. So I think it's pretty frustrated and, behind the scenes, possibly upset.
And Vietnam does not have any of its citizens aboard that plane, as far as we know. So this was purely a humanitarian effort.
Yeah, I think when the news broke that the plane might be between Malaysia and Vietnam, it gave Vietnam a reason to jump into this huge international story, and it didn't have any responsibility for the problem, but it could potentially help. So it could have been a pretty win-win situation for Vietnam without much cost, besides obviously monetary cost. But it's not turning out as well as maybe they thought initially.
Reporter Lien Huang speaking from Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam, with VOA's Susan Yockey. Sid McGurick, Associate Professor of Air Traffic Management at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, discusses why the search for the missing Malaysian Airlines plane is very difficult. He calls it one of the most bizarre sets of circumstances he's ever seen in his career, as he spoke with Daybreak Asia's Catherine Maddox.
Well, based upon my expertise, this is one of the most bizarre sets of circumstances I've ever seen. I really don't know what's going on there, and anything I say would be pure speculation. My heart goes out to the families of the victims because we have a tendency to forget that there are human beings on board these aircraft. And so I don't know what's going on between the military and the civilian government, but the folks who lost loved ones need to have some information.
Have you ever analyzed similar situations like this? I'm thinking of the Air France flight in 2009. Are there any similarities on the surface that you can see?
Well, the similarity, of course, is that the two aircraft apparently were lost over a large body of water. The Air France was a little bit different, at least so far. We'll have to find out when more facts come to light. But the difficulty of finding a wreckage over large bodies of water without radar coverage is pretty intense.
And again, and I realize that this is speculation, but have you figured out in your mind what might possibly have happened? And could you share that with us?
Well, there are diminishing numbers of scenarios that go through my head right now. First of all, the aircraft has been overdue for a significant period of time. And so I think we can come to the conclusion that it's not still in the air. It may very well have gone down to an airport someplace. I mean, somebody decided they wanted to steal a 777. I suppose that's possible. But when you steal a very large aircraft, you need a very large runway. And so my suspicion is that nobody tried to steal this aircraft. The other two possibilities then, at least that come to my mind, are one is that they had a catastrophic event on board the aircraft. That could be a human intervention. It could be a mechanical intervention. The plane, though, the 777, has a very, very good reputation for being a very safe aircraft. And so it could have been that someone decided to hijack the aircraft. It could have been a pilot on board decided to do something. But who knows?
In your estimation, or could you give us an educated guess, about how long it would take for us to get at least some signs of debris or anything to indicate possibly where the plane went down?
The debris field, if the plane did go down, the debris field, if it went down over water, would be significant. Unless, of course, the pilot decided to land the aircraft like the U.S. Airways flight in the Hudson and landed very gently and then just have it sink. I guess that would be one way of doing it without a debris field. But if it impacted on the water, there's definitely going to be a debris field. The curious piece about this set of circumstances is that we don't even know where to begin to look. And when you start to look at large bodies of water, it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. It really is. I mean, the Air France piece over the Atlantic was a huge grid that they had to follow before they actually found the aircraft. And it was several years before they were able to recover the cockpit voice recorder or the flight data recorder and actually come to some conclusion about what happened to that aircraft. The issue here is that there seems to be some conflicting information from the military and from the civilian end about which direction the aircraft was actually going. And until we sort through that, we're not going to begin to even know where to start to look. The FAA and the NTSB, I understand, have folks on site near the area where the aircraft allegedly went down. And so I have a great deal of respect for both of those institutions. They're very methodical. They're very organized, and they'll pull the radar tapes and the radio tapes, and they'll begin to walk through the mystery in a logical fashion. But ultimately, the bottom line for us, for all of us, is we won't know for certain until we find the cockpit voice recorder and the data recorder.
Sid McGurick, Associate Professor of Air Traffic Management at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, speaking with Daybreak Asia's Catherine Maddox. With no official information as to why Malaysia Airlines MH370 disappeared en route to Beijing and many conflicting stories and ideas, it's impossible to know right now what happened to the plane. Still, everyone has an opinion on this mysterious event. What do you think? You can join our poll found at voanews.com/daybreakasia to register your thoughts. Now, normally we unveil the final results of our polls Monday morning, but this week we're giving you a running total to see how this is trending. So far, about 34% feel terrorism is involved. That's down from 4% from just yesterday, which means people are now thinking of other possible causes for the disappearance. Almost 25% think mechanical failure is to blame. Up sharply, though, is human error from 10 to 15%. And more than 2% of you say weather played a factor. That would include darkness because it was an overnight flight. Still, a large number, 23%, just don't know based on what we do know so far. Again, our poll is at voanews.com/daybreakasia. It's unscientific, but an interesting reflection of what you and others in our audience are thinking. South Korea and Japan held vice ministerial-level talks Wednesday in Seoul to discuss improving strained relations. The meeting between Japan's vice foreign minister and the South Korean counterpart is the country's highest-level diplomatic interaction in months. Relations between the two Asian powers have plummeted over what Seoul considers Tokyo's unapologetic stance toward Japan's imperialist past. A tragic and bloody attack earlier this month at a train station in southwestern China has prompted a growing discussion about the country's anti-terrorism legislation. Authorities say terrorists from China's remote Xinjiang region plotted and carried out the assault. Lawmakers say China still lacks the right laws and tools to fight what has become an increasing threat to the country's security. Rebecca Valley reports from Hong Kong.
Chinese authorities say terrorists from the remote region of Xinjiang plotted and carried out the deadly attack at Kunming Station that left 29 dead and 143 injured. The attack underscores the challenges China faces in dealing with increasingly frequent unrest in Xinjiang, an area that authorities say has become a breeding nest for terrorism. The assault occurred just days before a major political meeting the National People's Congress opened in Beijing. Now, lawmakers are pushing to adopt a national law to better protect the country from the threat of terrorism. Zhao Bingzhi is the dean of the law school at Beijing Normal University. He says recent terrorist attacks by groups such as the East Turkestan Islamic Movement show the reality of terrorism infiltrating Chinese society. He says China must learn from other developed countries and establish a comprehensive, systematic, and specialized anti-terrorism law. Since the September 11 attacks in the United States in 2001, the world has faced an increasingly difficult challenge from terrorism. To prevent terrorism more effectively, Zhao says governments need legislation to strengthen their investigative powers. In China, terrorism is considered one of the three main evils threatening the country's stability, together with religious extremism and separatism. That is why discussions about terrorism are deeply linked with long-running unrest in Xinjiang, home to the Muslim Uyghur ethnic minority. Barry Sotman, a professor at the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, studies China's ethnic policies.
To some extent, China is filling in a hole which other countries have already filled in. But, of course, that doesn't mean that up till now China hasn't had some mechanisms for punishing people who were convicted of terrorism.
To prosecute crimes of terrorism, China has relied on a number of different provisions in its criminal code, and punishment has varied depending on the charges invoked by the court. Since 2001, amendments to the criminal code have included provisions to punish those who financially support terrorism, as well as more severe punishment for terrorist acts. With violent acts, individuals have been charged with crimes such as leading a terrorist organization, murder, arson, or damaging property. In other instances, such as with the Uyghur scholar Ilham Tohti, individuals have been charged with separatism after they openly criticize government policy towards Xinjiang.
It's not so much because the Chinese government feels it needs a greater set of laws to deal with the specific actions that result from terrorist activities. Rather, it's to show that China is part of a war on terror, in conjunction with several other states in the world that have similarly been affected by terrorist action.
The Kunming train station attack and another incident in Tiananmen Square last October have raised concerns that increasingly common dissent and violence in Xinjiang is now starting to spill over to other parts of China, threatening public safety. Raffaello Pantucci is a senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. He says Chinese authorities are under pressure to do more to prevent terrorism.
How do you counter messages that are being put out by terrorist organizations to sort of radicalize individuals or to persuade individuals to carry out certain acts? How do you prevent the development of ideological networks which turn into sort of terrorist cells? How do you identify this whole sort of range of things that are specifically going to end up in sort of violent acts versus ones that may just end up in political acts? I think the Chinese system is still not really connected all the aspects up.
Law school dean Zhao Bingzhi says that because of the complex nature of the issue, agreement on a draft anti-terrorism law will take some time. Rebecca Valli in Hong Kong for VOA.
Hong Kong police say 9 people have been arrested in connection with a vicious attack on a former newspaper editor. Kevin Lau received serious wounds to his torso and legs after being attacked last month by a man with a meat cleaver. Mainland authorities arrested 2 men, while Hong Kong police arrested 7 others in connection with the attack. China's growing influence in the world has included expanding military capabilities. And while we could never fully know all of China's abilities, we can examine circumstantial evidence to build a good framework of knowledge about strengths and limitations that we would expect to see from China. The nation has not been engaged in a substantial military conflict for almost 40 years, yet China has watched conflicts around the world and since that time has moved to keep its forces updated should it find itself at war. Tai Ming-Chung is the director of the University of California Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation in San Diego. He, along with several colleagues, has been assessing China's level of defense technology innovation. Their findings are in the new book, Forging China's Military Might, to which Tai Ming-Chung contributed and edited.
The book comes out of a long-term research project that I've been in charge on, funded by the U.S. Defense Department a number of years ago, to look at some of the long-term security challenges for the U.S. The initiative, entitled the Minerva Initiative, funds social science research to look at these big security questions. And one of the areas that they funded was looking at China's rise as a technology and innovation power. A significant focus of the research that we've been doing is to try to understand and explain China's rise as a defense innovation power and what that means for the rest of the world and for the U.S. in particular.
This book is a compilation of several contributors. Tell me a little bit about how all these people came together to write on this topic for you.
The people that were involved, around about 10 to 12 people, they came to a conference that we held back in the summer of 2011. And what we do is that we run an annual conference looking at the political economy of Chinese defense power. And one of the issues that we were trying to do is, how do we rigorously analyze the state of Chinese defense industrial, scientific, and technological innovation? And so I assembled a number of people from around the world. And in the book, the majority of our U.S. analysts, we also have people from Singapore and from other countries, to be able to take a systematic look at the key elements at play in explaining innovation and creative development in China.
The subtitle of the book is A New Framework for Assessing Innovation. China has long been criticized for copying, stealing, right, emulating. How much innovation is really going on within their military at this point?
The Chinese actually have a fairly clear-cut strategy. They call this the IDAR strategy, which is they introduce, which is they bring in, they digest, they assimilate, re-innovate. And the key part about understanding Chinese innovation itself is that there's 2 types of innovations that the Chinese are trying to achieve, especially in the defense sphere, but also more broadly. One is what they call just good enough innovation, where it's like they don't need to have like a really advanced, sophisticated approach, but it's having technological capabilities that are just good enough, that are cost-effective, that match the characteristics of their country. Or the other approach, which is what the U.S. and more advanced countries produce, is the breakthrough, the gold-plated type of innovation, the very, very like frontier type of innovation. And the Chinese are doing that, but that's not where a lot of their focus is. Their focus is on just good enough right now.
In terms of military, if you're behind, it must be very difficult to bring yourself up to par with, you know, the leaders out there. And if China is a catch-up nation, can they ever hope to really catch up with, say, the U.S. military?
It's a very long-term approach. I mean, the Chinese have only been really seriously engaged in this catch-up technology and innovation effort in the last 20 years. Odd years. And so what they see is that there's different races that the Chinese are pursuing. There's the immediate race where they're worried about their external security environment, where it's dealing with Japan or the U.S. strategic pivot or Taiwan or these like immediate concerns. And so in those types of efforts where the warfighters, the military, they want equipment that they can use right now, they import and they do this re-innovation strategy that allows them to get just good enough capabilities. But then the Chinese military and the defense industrial apparatus also says, well, we also have to keep our eye on the long term. So we have to make investments in our research and development base that may not lead to capabilities in the next 5-10 years, but 20 or 30 years.
Are we finding ourselves in somewhat of an arms race at this point in the sense of trying to stay ahead of China?
I think there is an increasing sense of that. The U.S. has been trying to downplay this direct arms race. It's much more of an indirect developments that are taking place because the U.S. looks at China, but China is not quite where the Soviet Union was in the Cold War days before the 1990s. China is one of several countries that the U.S. needs to keep attention on itself. But I think that if China is able to continue to make the rapid progress that it showed in defense science and technology in the last decade, and if they continue or accelerate this progress in the next 5-10 years, I think the U.S. will become even more concerned than they are now.
Innovation isn't limited to just having the biggest and baddest toys out there on the planet. It's also knowing how to use them. And China, I would imagine, is also trying to work on that front to better use and utilize what they do have.
That is a big issue, and this is something that China's new leader, Xi Jinping, talks about often. Xi Jinping has been in power for the last 14, 15 months, and whenever he goes to talk to the Chinese military or he goes to their defense science and technology factories and laboratories, he talks about, well, we come up with these really good capabilities and technologies, but we really have to know how to use it because if China gets into war, we need to be prepared to be able to win. And that's the conundrum that the Chinese military faces. The Chinese military are still in the very early stages of trying to understand what they call this revolution in military affairs, these new technology are. And they still are not very good at being able to actually use them. So while we see the Chinese military beginning to project their power, there is a concern that we have a very inexperienced military that may lead to accidents and confrontation.
Tai Ming Chung, editor and contributor to the book Forging China's Military Might, A New Framework for Assessing Innovation, published by Johns Hopkins. Tai Ming Chung is the director of the University of California Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation in San Diego. We're about to publish the latest world news. To give you a personalized reading is Steve Norman, next on International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online.